From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The sandy soil of West Africa was primed to farm peanuts. As the popularity of the legume increased, so did the need for labor. In the new book, Slaves for Peanuts, journalist Jory Lewis dives into how peanut cultivation in Senegal supported the rise and fall of slavery. Hi, Jory.
Hi.
Does your family have a personal experience with farming peanuts?
Well, yeah. It turns out it was my great-great-grandfather who farmed peanuts on their farm in Arkansas, but then they stopped.
And yet this book centers on Senegal. Why did you choose to tell that story from a place that is relatively small?
Well, I've been living in Senegal for the past decade, you know, mostly. And Senegal, despite its small size, some say the size of South Dakota, has managed for the over 100 years to be a top 10 peanut grower in the world almost always. So I was interested in the kind of outsized impact that the peanut has on Senegal's economy, or had on Senegal's economy traditionally, and also its kind of outsized impact in the world as well, just being a small country producing so many peanuts.
Where did the peanut originate?
So the peanuts originated in South America. It sort of evolved in a part of Bolivia. And then it moved throughout the continent. So there have been reports of peanuts in like Incan graves and in the Caribbean and the Brazilian coast. So the peanuts sort of just spread far and wide, and as well as in Mexico. So the peanuts sort of spread through South America to Central America to the Caribbean.
And do we know how and when the peanut made it to Africa?
Well, the leading assumption is that it was brought over by probably early conquistadors, early so-called explorers. I talk about it in the book that, you know, even on Columbus's first voyage, he talks about all these agricultural crops he's kind of like eyeing, you know, to possibly take back to Europe or to other places where Europeans, especially from the Iberian Peninsula, already had sort of trade relationships. And Africa must have been one of those places. The Portuguese especially had already established pretty good trading relationships in the 15th century before the so-called discovery of the New World.
So I'm curious how you approached your research to determine what you call lost stories. You ask the question, how do we tell the stories of people that history forgets and the present avoids?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I mean, I approached it with just dogged, you know, sort of dogged research. I mean, doing a historical research, especially something sort of so far away in time, where you don't really have any living descendants of that period, you have to rely on the archival materials. So I just tried to sort of triage in a way, like all the materials that I could find. So between the actual sort of archival administrative materials, court documents, register lists, I get a lot of the sort of names of the enslaved from this regular publication that would happen in the colony's newspaper that listed the people who had been freed in the past month. There are accounts in sort of fables. There's oral history. The missionary archives as well have like a different perspective, right? They're kind of propaganda. At the same time, their mission is to kind of uplift certain voices. And then in some cases, I did try to do some amount of a kind of oral history, just to sort of trying to understand how people passed on the stories about their lives. Even if the details aren't exactly accurate, it's the feeling of the story that matters.
Can you explain who Walter Samuel Taylor was and how you landed on him to use as a through line to tell the history of the peanut in Senegal?
I sort of stumbled upon a sort of reference to Walter Taylor in another book, just that there had been a Sierra Leonean Protestant missionary in the capital of colonial Senegal at the time, Saint-Louis. It's unusual for a number of reasons, right? The Senegal was then and still is now a wild majority Muslim. It's like, I think, in between 90 or 95% Muslim. The north of the Senegal, I always like to say, was Islamized 1,000 years ago. So Islam is old in the region. And then, you know, it's a French colony, so that the sort of religion of the colony had been for many years Catholicism. So Walter Taylor was a man of liberated African origin, which means liberated Africans were a sort of class of people who were resettled from slave ships and resettled in Sierra Leone in the hills around Freetown. So these are people who had been enslaved, had been put on slave ships, and then the British Royal Navy intercepted them and brought them to Freetown, didn't take them back to their own countries, because in a way it was a difficult proposition to do. So his parents were liberated African. Walter Taylor himself was born in just outside of Freetown. And then he eventually came to the region of Senegal, he says, to work for the British Navy. And then eventually he starts working for a Boston shipmaster who's exporting peanuts from the west coast of Africa to the United States, to Boston and New Haven and New York and places like that. From there, Walter Taylor has some kind of religious awakening and joins the French Protestant mission as an evangelist, and eventually creates the signature program of the French Protestant mission, which is this refuge for runaway slaves.
Can you talk to us about how the growth of peanut farming and the peanut industry went hand in hand or supported the slave trade in Africa?
It's not a sort of direct relationship in a way. When demand for the peanut grows in Europe in the mid-19th century, for a lot of reasons, mostly for making soap, but also for other reasons related to the Industrial Revolution in general and just the kind of large demand for oil, the demand for peanuts means that so the French, from their colonial outposts, which are almost all on small islands or peninsulas on the coast, they sort of ask the people in the interior of the continent to grow more peanuts. They're kind of like peanut boosters, the French merchants. But there's not enough labor to put more land into production. So in order to put more land into production, people need bodies to grow peanuts. Slavery always existed in Africa, but the transatlantic slave trade expanded and, let's say, accelerated a kind of enslavement in the processes by which free people were made enslaved, namely war. Just because the slave trade itself ended, the transatlantic trade ended, it didn't sort of stop the processes that were already happening. So there are still a number of captives of war who have been enslaved. These people are still being created in the interior, and they kind of find a willing market in the peanut lands of Senegal and parts of Guinea and the Gambia at this time when trade is having an uptick.
When did peanut oil replace the slave trade as a, quote, legitimate commodity? And how does urbanization and the Industrial Revolution factor into that scenario?
So the legitimate commerce is a sort of term that many abolitionists are using because they're trying to outlaw the trade. They sort of say that instead of trading in slaves, there are any number of other items they might trade in. So with the so-called legitimate commerce. And so peanuts are one of many things that that are sort of proposed as legitimate trade. There's coffee, there's ivory, there's, you know, honey and hides for leather and palm oil and peanut oil kind of both serve the same function. There's a kind of run on oil in Europe for greasing the new machines of the Industrial Revolution, but also for lamps, for cooking, especially in France, for soap. And the peanut, it turns out, has a chemical makeup that's very close to olive oil in some ways, and fit in to, you know, the recipe for the kind of classic French soap, the Savon de Marseille. That's kind of why the sort of uptick in demand for peanuts happened.
So interesting. Thank you so much. That was fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
That's journalist Jory Lewis, who lives part-time in Dakar, Senegal. She writes about the environment and agriculture. Slaves for Peanuts is her first book. Coming up, the hot, hot heat of another drought-ridden summer is about to arrive, and all of our plants are thirstier than any TikTok influencer. How do we keep them alive with all the water restrictions?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food. If you're like me, the issue of watering your garden hits home, especially when you watch your plants struggle through another week of 90 and 100 degree temperatures. The days of pulling out the hose and just letting it run are long gone. I met Yvonne Savio so many years ago when I was interested in the Master Gardener program here in Los Angeles County. She was already a noted horticulturalist. Currently, she maintains demonstration and trial gardens in Southern and Northern California, specializing in drought-tolerant techniques for growing vegetables, fruits, perennials, roses, and succulents. Welcome, Yvonne.
Thanks so much, Evan. It's nice to chat with you again.
What are some of the mistakes we're making when we water our gardens?
Folks who are having trouble with those plants are not considering far enough ahead of time that it is going to be too hot for those plants. And also how deep the roots of those plants are going to be. Whether they've achieved that by the time the heat comes or not later on, and also matching plants growing together in the garden so that they have everybody in one space has the same needs for water, either a lot or not very much.
It's interesting that you brought up this idea of where in the life cycle a plant is by the time the heat hits. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it's always going to be at least a couple weeks. And if you start with a smaller plant, it may take a little longer. But the real trick is to teach the plants as soon as you get them in to grow deeply in chasing that water rather than just giving them a little sprinkle every day, which makes you feel better, but it doesn't help the plants a whole lot. We have been very lucky, so it's been relatively mild for this whole long spring that we've had. And consequently, the plants are doing a good job of just kind of carrying on. And the water is what really tips them off to whether they can get a really good grip on the soil that they're trying to spread their roots out into, or whether they are kind of held back because of either too much or too little water.
So for those of us who didn't think far enough ahead when preparing where we plant our plants, and we didn't, for example, put in like a drip system, what are some techniques we can do that allow the water to be delivered deep enough for the root systems to benefit without flooding the garden, which now that we're in this serious drought is just not a good idea?
I have my own secret, obviously no longer a secret when I tell you, method that came about as a result of having to recycle those 5-gallon containers that nursery plants come in, especially if you buy a fruit tree. What I did was I had access to a huge number of those at one point, and so I buried them halfway into the soil between those plants. For example, perhaps your tomatoes are a good 2.5 feet apart. Well, right in between, dig a hole that is maybe 6, 7, 8, 9 inches deep, put that 5-gallon container in there, and then fill the container with water. The water goes down through those holes, which are now those 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 inches into the soil, directly to where those root systems are of your tomatoes. And the additional trick is to put just a single shovelful of manure or compost into that bin, because then every time you water, that is going to be manure tea or compost tea going out of those holes at the bottom of the container straight to doing a very mild feeding of those plants. And the real trick of all this is that getting the water out to the plant root system that deeply means it's not going to be affected by these tremendous heat waves that we may have.
If we don't have a lot of room to put in many of those 5-gallon containers, what are some other options that we have to allow water to percolate more slowly into the soil or be more directed? Should we be using bubblers?
Yeah, the bubbler is very good. Also, the soaker hoses that I call a leaky hose, these are the ones that don't have a puncture every 6 inches or a foot. These are the ones that the whole hose leaks. You know, it just oozes the water all along its complete length. And what you can do is just lay it in the bed around each of the plants that you have installed. The mini tube drip emitters are okay, I guess, but I have never been happy with them because they did not provide water for the entire area in the bed.
Is there a basic timing schedule for watering that you can share with us throughout each season?
Yeah, but the critical thing is how long to water, which is based on your soil. You know, if you've got sandy soil, the water is going to go very quickly down beyond what perhaps is the root system of the plant. Whereas if you have heavier clay soil, it is more compact. So for the same kind of plant, it may be half an hour for one, but it may be an hour for another, depending on the soil. That's what the real critical part is. You know, each plant has its own genetic basis on how deep those roots are going to go, whether it's only to a single foot, which is going to be like carrots or celery, lettuce, onions, or whether it's going to go 2 feet deep, which could be beans, and of course, the longer carrots, cucumbers, eggplants, peppers, squash, and the really deep ones that the roots could get to 3 feet deep is going to be your tomatoes and your pumpkins, your melons, artichokes, and asparagus. So what your point is to water it long enough for the water to get down to the bottommost roots.
So once we have taught ourselves how to water deeply and effectively, how often do we need to water?
If you reach into the soil just with your fingertips, I mean, like your whole finger, if it's dry a good 2-3 inches down then that's time to water. If it's still moist to that depth of your fingers, then you can probably wait at least a week, perhaps. People assume that because a plant might be droopy at the end of the day, you know, like we get droopy at the end of our days because we're out of energy, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the plant needs to be watered.
Over the last few years, as our weather has changed a bit, have you noticed vegetables flowering and setting fruit earlier?
Well, certainly I have had a difficulty this year again with trying to grow my broccoli rabe and some of the other brassicas like arugula and things like that. The first ones, it was too early in the fall. They would immediately bolt. They would go elongate out and put out those little flowers. And then it got cold enough where I didn't get good germination. And then it got hot again. So it was certainly the same kind of frustration.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Yvonne.
My pleasure.
That was noted California horticulturalist Yvonne Savio. We'll have a link to her blog and newsletter on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Waste not, want not. It sums up State Senate Bill 1383, which went into effect on January 1st of this year. It requires California cities and counties to divert 75% of all organic waste from landfills by the end of 2025. How close are we to achieving this goal? And what does it mean for your community? Michael Martinez is the executive director of LA Compost, and he has an update. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Good. I was so happy when I heard about this Senate bill. And then I, you know, understood that it would take LA a lot of time to kind of digest it. So can you talk about the bill in a bit of detail and then kind of tell us how California is dealing with it and then Los Angeles?
Yeah, absolutely. So Senate Bill SB 1383 is really a bill that is focused on 75% reduction in landfill organic waste by 2025, with the inevitable goal long-term of 100% reduction of organic waste in landfills.
Why exactly are we doing it? What is the need to get all of this organic matter out of landfills?
It's really vital and important to remove organic material from landfills due to the very nature of what happens to organic material when it enters a landfill. Prior to even getting to a landfill, there's several vehicle miles traveled to get from point of origination to the landfill destination. And then when food scraps do enter a landfill, they break down in an anaerobic process, which means without air, which causes a greenhouse gas, which kind of is contributing to this super pollutant or climate emergency that we're currently in.
In all of this infrastructure of trash haulage, is there anybody currently in this space dealing with compost?
Yes, a lot of haulers across the state have been, many in Northern California, some in Central, and even in Southern California. I think there's a little bit of lag in the compost facilities that are being built to match and meet the moment with the collection.
So when most of us think about composting, I think we think of either one of those little tiny tumblers that people might have in their backyards, or open piles that people layer with dried carbon-rich materials and edible waste, and then turn. What kind of systems will municipalities be looking to create to deal with the quantity?
It's kind of one of two options from what I've been seeing. The first innovative is kind of anaerobic digestion, where facilities are built and the material is brought to that facility. And one of the outputs that comes from anaerobic digestion is methane that they are able to convert to a natural gas, which can support the vehicles. Another type of infrastructure that I've been seeing is large-scale windrow piles. So similar to the piles we create at community gardens, urban parks, and urban farms, municipalities and haulers and companies are creating large-scale windrow piles that are turned by large-scale machines and bucket loaders and windrow turners, or using windrow piles where there's forced aeration. A windrow is essentially a large compost lasagna pile that is stacked in multiple layers of organic material and can stretch from 20 feet to 100 plus feet.
Yeah, I think many of us have wondered why we couldn't just put our organic trash in with the lawn materials in the green cans.
Yeah, I think that's the inevitable goal of the city. One of the reasons in which we can't just put food scraps in right now is where that material is going to. Every facility has to be properly permitted to be able to process and compost certain ingredients. And with a lot of the green bin material, specifically within the city of LA, that is going to facilities that oftentimes aren't permitted for processing food scraps that are coming out of the kitchen or post-consumer kind of scraps. That is going to change soon.
So interesting, the choices. I mean, one can imagine one day have your own tiny anaerobic digester on your property that would then feed your electric car. But
yeah, I like all the innovation. I'm in favor as well of a lot of systems and solutions, but very much favor solutions that support healthy soil for sure.
So with large-scale windrow composting, do municipalities then allow residents to get the finished compost for free?
That's the idea. I know within the LA Sanitation Program at the moment, they have free mulch pile giveaways. And then at their Griffith Park and Silmer Lopez Canyon facility, they also have compost distribution days. I think as more material is collected and processed, there will absolutely be more finished material. And the idea and the hope and the goal is to get that material back to residents, back to growers, back to green spaces.
How much edible food or organic food matter from our meal preparation goes into landfills?
Quite a bit. I think the most recent stats that CalRecycle put out for the state was roughly 24 million tons in a single year of just material. But in regards to food, it's roughly about just under 20% of all material that goes into our waste stream.
Since these systems are going to take a while to get up and running, what do you think about the countertop composters that tend to be pretty expensive?
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of those come out, and I feel like there's mixed reactions and feelings, and I feel like the ones that I've seen and used very much dry out the material, grind the material, and dehydrate the material. And that's good for an individual user, being that there's no smells, there's no fruit flies, but there's still another step that needs to happen with that material. It still needs to be buried. It still needs to perhaps be put in a composter. It still needs to finish, because it's not a ready-to-use material that you can just put in the garden, from what I've seen.
If we want to start doing something good with our food waste, are there drop-off programs?
Absolutely. So that's kind of the ethos of what we provide at LA Compost. And we're really working to restore lost connections to the soil and one another. And our efforts of community composting is to create a wide web of drop-off locations. So we have both community drop-off locations, which are at community gardens, some are at schools, libraries. And then one of our fastest growing programs is dropping off at farmers markets. We are working with the city of LA to launch 20 farmers market drop-off locations by the end of next year.
Michael, do you have any sense of the timeline it'll be before, for example, the DWP says, go ahead, throw things in that green bin and it gets carted away?
I do see it potentially happening over the next 2 years. And it may be a slow rollout where they do it district by district, but I do see it absolutely happening before 2024.
Thank you so much, Michael. I really appreciate you coming to the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for your time and for the invite.
Michael Martinez is the executive director of LA Compost. For more information on how to compost and a timeline for rolling out mandatory composting in your community, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, you've probably heard of community gardens. How about community composting? That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Even trash doesn't go to waste at Serenity Garden in South Pomona. When you arrive, a sign asks you to toss your food scraps into a hole in the ground. That's because this isn't just a community garden. It's a community composting site. That means you can drop off your food scraps and they'll be turned into nutrient-rich soil for urban farmers, gardeners, and local parks. As Senate Bill 1383 forces California cities and counties to divert more organic waste away from landfills, Helen Neely, Serenity Gardens founder, thinks community composting is part of the solution. Hi, Helen.
Hi. It's good to be here.
I'm glad that you're on the show. What is community composting?
Well, community composting is where the community is coming together to give back to the soil what it is that we have borrowed.
How do the composting hubs operate?
Food scraps come in. They are given the time and the space to degrade themselves back to their original nutrients. And then they are distributed where they can be used into the soil by plants.
Are there community composting hubs all over the city? Is yours available for people who are not using the community garden to come and just drop off food scraps?
When we have events in the garden, then the space is available to be used. The community compost hubs are all over Pomona. And in those spaces, that's where the community is able to come in.
Why did you decide to start Serenity Garden?
I started Serenity Garden as a learning space. So it's an outdoor classroom that is used for Greener STEM students and the community around the garden.
What is Greener STEMs?
Greener STEMs is a learning opportunity for those who are willing to learn how to grow themselves. And so we're using our space around us to learn how to become greener ourselves. We're literally growing ourselves as sustainable technologists, engineers, mathematicians, and scientists. But we're overall learning how to grow ourselves.
Gosh, what a great combination of subjects. So I would love if we could talk a bit sort of composting 101 for those who might not know how it works at the most basic level.
Well, it just sort of depends on what it is that they are bringing into the garden. If it's something that is edible for our red wiggling worms, we will open up the worm bin and we'll allow them to put in what it is that they're bringing. And the worms will then eat them. And over the course of maybe a month or so, we'll find that we have worm poop, which can then be just left with some water and brewed just like the tea that I had this morning and added to some soil for plants to feed on. If it's something that is not in the best diet for our worms, like say a peeling of a pineapple or an orange, citrus, then we'll go ahead and we'll put it into the hole where we will allow it to decompose. Just with a little bit of time and some water and some air, we might cover it a little bit with some type of hay or something, then it will take its course.
This process of just putting plant material into a hole, is that called keyhole composting?
Yes, that is called keyhole composting because we're putting it into a keyhole. It's a keyhole because there are things that are growing around that hole. So where it decomposes into the soil, it will leach out, the nutrients leach out into the area that's surrounding that hole.
Where did you learn about keyhole composting?
Very good question. I actually learned while I was traveling with a friend. She had shared with me that this was an old African practice. And so I said, well, you know, it sounds simple enough. Let me go home and try it myself.
To what extent do you think community composting hubs can be a hyperlocal way to combat climate change?
Through awareness. And if it's not something that we have to do in our home, but we can all go out and connect in one spot, like in the Serenity Garden, it's just a common place. You bring your food scraps and you contribute and we move on with our lives instead of it having to be some grand event. Because it's just how we are operating in our regular functions, it's something that can become long-term. And long-term change makes grand change.
That's so true. In 2020, Cal Recycle awarded a $1.5 million grant to the California Alliance for Community Composting in order to support the development of 120 new community composting hubs all across the state, and nearly half of them are in the Los Angeles area. And Governor Newsom set aside $5 million for community composting. Has Serenity Garden received any of these funds?
Serenity Garden has received the benefits of the funds. So there has been work contributed towards Serenity Garden that is being funded by these monies that you speak of. There are a certain number of people who have donated their time to organizing particular events. And these things take manpower. So it's just me and the families that work with me. But every now and then we need some manpower to do some building or some organizing around the city. And this is where we find that the funds are being seen in our particular garden.
And have you seen kind of a boom or at least an uptick in work of community composting sites because of this infusion of funds?
I have. And that's for one, I would say, in the community gardens that are surrounding the city of Pomona. There have been some resources that have been provided, so composting bins, things to that nature. Also, like I said, the manpower needed in order to maintain these compost bins.
Most community composting sites are relatively small. Is there a way for them to scale up, and is that a good thing?
There may be a way. Wherever there's a will, there is a way, but it may shift the focus of what that community is actually intended to come together for. So that's something to consider. Maybe more so to increase the impact by just sharing, for example, what I'm doing now. I'm not expecting that all of the listeners are now going to come to Serenity Garden and come to all of our activities and events simply because they've heard this message. But maybe someone might be inspired. Someone whom I never will meet in person, but inspired to do something in their own space, even if it's just adding something to a little pot of soil that has a strawberry plant in it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time for us. It's very interesting what you're doing there at Serenity Garden.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
That was Hevela Neely, who runs community composting hub Serenity Garden in South Pomona. To find the location of a community composting site near you, go to our website at kcrw.org/goodfood. Back in 2019, the Los Angeles Times named Cato Los Angeles's best restaurant. Chef and owner John Yao recently moved the restaurant across town from its West LA location to a spot in the Arts District. Restaurant critic Bill Addison joins us to answer whether Cato remains a, quote, singular Los Angeles culinary experience, unquote. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear you, too. So what is the answer to that question? Does it remain a singular Los Angeles culinary experience?
Absolutely, it does. Yes. Although it is changing and moving fast in terms of its ambitions, it still has the absolute soul of a Los Angeles restaurant.
Give us a bit of background about Chef John Yao. I understand that originally his parents had leased that tiny little space in West LA to operate a catering business. When did John end up taking over?
Yes, they had an idea to create lunchboxes for UCLA students. This was back in 2016. And John, who had toyed with the idea of going to law school and then dropped that idea, was then 25 years old and eventually took it over and was kind of just given, because his parents had leased the space, free rein to do what he wanted. He had staged at very fancy tasting menu restaurants like Bennu in San Francisco. And he started creating a tasting menu of things that just kind of interested him at first, a mix of Japanese and Taiwanese and Chinese flavors. And the more he cooked, the more his ideas coalesced into something that was really about his personal narrative, more focused on the flavors that he knew growing up. His parents immigrated from Taiwan. They are of Chinese descent. And when he started toying with those ideas, things like taking the very famous like 3-cup chicken casserole and distilling it into its essential flavors of sesame and soy and basil and putting it with abalone, say, it was something that felt ever more fresh and personal and exciting for people who care about food in Los Angeles.
And as I remember, it was a 5-course tasting menu at a price that was fairly approachable for a tasting restaurant. And it was in a tiny little space.
Yes, it was around 120, I think. And so in this new space, which they moved into in February in Row DTLA, after searching for a new space for several years, it has leapt in price without question. It's around $225 per person right now, and a much longer menu, probably a dozen or more courses.
And a completely different space, which changes the experience, I thought.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very similar to the previous occupant, M. Georgina, in that the kitchen is semi-open and there's a wood-burning stove and a short bar off to the side. But in the context of Cato, it feels fresh and bustling and much more energized, much less hushed than the tiny, quiet space in West LA.
Yeah, I really felt like this move to this space, it just sort of fits his ambition a bit more.
Oh, very much. Although it's interesting because John Yao is always a chef who likes to have his head down during service. He doesn't survey the dining room very much. He leaves that to his partners. And you can look over and see him. He's the one with very closely cropped hair, usually bent quietly over whatever he's preparing.
So the format still remains a tasting menu with supplements. Is it for you more difficult to review a tasting menu since you know that your readers may miss dishes as chefs weave them in and out of the lineup?
You know what? That's a really interesting question. And the answer is basically no, because so many restaurants these days have menus that are ever-changing or that flow with the season or with inspiration. So I would say a tasting menu is no different. I'm trying in a review to really convey the essence of what a chef is up to and what the ambitions of the restaurant are and whether they're meeting those ambitions. And I think Cato is no different.
And we should say that the restaurant does have a fish focus. After all, that's their logo.
Yes, very seafood and vegetable focused. And I would say just a little bit of meat at the end, which almost feels superfluous to me, honestly.
And what were some of the highlights for you of the last time that you ate there?
There is an incredible scallop dish. It's one perfect scallop over fragrant fish sauce. And the scallop has been fried super lightly. It's an amalgamation of dishes that Yao remembers from childhood, and the flavors are just like big and focused and fresh and herbal and a little spicy. I love that dish. There's another one that comes to mind, Goldeneye Snapper, that was served over fermented cabbage and Chinese mustard greens, and they pour over a broth tableside that's fish stock enriched with rice wine. It's a lot of bright, fresh flavors that feel familiar if you grew up with this kind of food or you eat in Chinese and Taiwanese restaurants, but it's very distilled and very intellectual, but also very satisfying as well.
Yeah, as a person who admires pursuits of the brain.
Yes.
I admire intellectual cuisine, but at the end for me, it has to also be a mouth experience.
Absolutely. And I feel like that's the most exciting thing to say about this evolution to Keto 2.0 is that it's kind of the breadth of his ambitions. It's everything that you thought you might be able to see in this chef and his fantastic front of house partners in that tiny LA space. Now they have the room, the staff, and the means, including a liquor license, which they never had before, to create something incredibly special, kind of world class, really.
Yeah. Let's talk about that liquor license and what he's doing with it. Talk about the cocktails and these tiered wine pairings that one can get.
Ryan Bailey is the sommelier in charge of the wine program, and he's also a partner now in the restaurant. And he's great. Just one of those, like, I feel like wine is always such a niche thing to talk about. And it's just more important to say, if you're curious about wine, if you want to taste things from regions that aren't quite familiar to you among, you know, the old world classics, it's just a great option to be able to do that.
So I'm hoping to get Ryan and Austin, the bar manager, in to talk about the non-alcoholic pairing, which I found absolutely singular and astounding.
The best I've ever had for a non-alcoholic pairing. I would 100% agree with you. That's really the brainchild of Austin Hennelly, who, as I understand, does not drink alcohol anymore. And they found all these incredible bottled juices that mimic the flavors of wine without having alcohol, and also some incredible cocktail pairings that veer from the cliches of that genre, whether they're like too sweet or they just taste like vinegar. These are like balanced, interesting creations that pair so well with the food.
So interesting. So definitely a spot not to miss if one can afford it.
And I would say too, you know, as someone who through my life, you know, I've not always been a restaurant critic. I've not always had the means to eat at a fancy restaurant. But if I were 25 years old and loved food as much as I did half a lifetime ago, this would probably be the one place in Los Angeles I would be happy to save up and experience as a special occasion.
That says a lot. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Evan.
Bill Addison is the Los Angeles Times restaurant critic. He joined us to talk about Keto at its new home in the Arts District. To find his recommendations for where to eat and what to order, visit our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Up next, if you love Keto, stick around. We head to the farmer's market with Chef John Yao. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Now let's head to the farmer's market where Jillian Ferguson has an update on what's in season this week in Southern California.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It is great to be back at the Santa Monica Farmers Market this week. It is peak summer, which means delicious fruit. And here to share some inspiration for the summer abundance is John Yao, chef and owner of Keto, and Nick Picciotto, who is the sous chef there. It's the much celebrated Michelin-starred restaurant that we heard Bill Addison talking about earlier on today's show. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Hi.
So I saw you, John, doing some R&D for a melon course that I wanted to talk about on today's program because it's melon season. And we all want to know what to do when we get home with our 10 pounds of melons from the farmer's market.
We do like a melon kakigori, but like every single thing in it has melon. So we do a Strauss yogurt and melon whip. We do a condensed milk with Strauss dairy as well, but we fold in like a melon consomme syrup type thing. And then we take that same syrup and we like marinate melons in it. And then we do a melon gelée and a melon sorbet too.
Wow. Okay, first we should say that the kakigori machine is a fancy Japanese shave ice machine, right?
Yeah, this one's like the top of the line. I forgot how many they said are in Los Angeles, but it's not many. Yeah.
And what is so special about it?
It's like the most powerful one. And we source it from the same people that we source our ice from. So we get like really pure like mountain water from Japan. And it comes as blocks for us. And the bar uses the same type of ice too.
Wow. Okay, so let's talk about all the melon components. Break it down for us. First of all, what kind of melons are you using? Nick, you want to answer this?
We're using Arava melons from Weiser.
Okay, the Arava melon is pretty unique. Tell us about that one.
It's a nice green melon, high acid, high sugar, super floral, flavorful. So it makes the syrup, it's gelée, it's cut, it's everywhere.
All right, so let's talk about some of these components in the dish, maybe starting with that consommé.
So we blend melons and then we strain it and then we season it with sugar until it's like a syrup. And then we'll use that syrup in different bases in the dessert. It goes into the yogurt whip, which is whipped yogurt, cream, and milk, just to thin it out a little. And it's folded into the melon consomme. And then we'll add some gelatin with that and then we'll season it with some sort of acid. And then that gets broken up to be the gelée. And then we'll cut the melons up and then season it with that consomme. And then that'll be our like marinated melon.
What was the inspiration for this dish?
Well, like usually for like when you eat like Chinese banquet meals, they end the meal with like cut fruit on ice. So we wanted that idea of like something ice and something fruit. So like when you eat like the dessert, it just registers as like you're eating like a mouthful of like that specific fruit.
Wow.
Yeah.
How much melon are you taking home from the market today, do you think?
80 pounds? Yeah, 80 pounds.
80 pounds of melon. Amazing. All right, well, this sounds delicious. Congratulations on all your great reviews, and thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was John Yao and Nick Picciotto of Kato at The Row in downtown Los Angeles. Alex Weiser is the farmer growing the melons that John just talked about. His table is quite literally weighed down with a huge variety of options. Alex, it's always wonderful to see you.
Same with you, Jillian. Nice to see you.
So let's start with those aromatic melons on the table, the orange flesh, the green flesh. Maybe you can pick one of each and tell us why you chose them.
Well, it's all about the best, sweetest, tastiest melons we can grow. We grow around 10 varieties, and all of them are different. We have orange musk melon that is dark orange and sweet. We have a French melon that's a cross of an ananas and a charente that is more of a cream color and it kind of has a creamsicle taste. We have charente and cavaillon, which are French cantaloupes. Very aromatic, delicious. And then we have green flesh melons. We have a Ogan melon and Arava, which are both Gallia type melons.
And what does that mean, a Gallia type melon?
It means it's a green flesh from the Middle East. Okay. It originates from the Middle East.
So John was talking about that Arava melon that you just described. Tell us about that one.
Well, originally from Israel. Arava is a desert in Israel and very popular there, has a nice netting related to the Ogan that we have, but that one is smoother skin. I'd say the Arava is a little sweeter. The Ogan has like a taste to it, like a custard taste.
Hmm.
There's subtle differences.
And you also grow a bunch of watermelon varieties, which I feel like every year there's just more and more types of watermelon. What did you choose this year?
Well, I chose the varieties that I think were the sweetest and most unique. Football-shaped red-fleshed watermelons, orange flesh, seeded, a few seedless. There's so many varieties and shapes and colors, and I love watermelon.
No square watermelon for you yet, though.
I'm working on it.
Really?
It's on my list. Yes, it's on my list.
Gotta have fun, right?
Yes, exactly.
So I've been buying your melons for years, and I feel like this season has just been so spectacular. I'm hearing that from chefs, too. And I wonder, is that just luck of the draw? How much does terroir actually impact melons?
You know what? It's about the soil, good soil. And we have the climate for great watermelons. But I hear that every year. This is the year. But it's a long season. We're just in the beginning. You know, we have melons till September because we plant in the interior of, you know, San Joaquin Valley at the base of the mountains and below Tehachapi. Getting a fresh vine-ripe melon that's picked where it's ripe from the vine and then to the market the next day, you can't, that's the next level. It's where you have the most nutritional value, the most flavor develop in those last few days on the plant. When you're picking for a shelf somewhere, there's the trucking time, there's shelf time. So you tend to pick it harder. So we have our Vine Ripe Express. We're only 100 miles from the market, so we let them get ripe and sell ripe melons.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
That was Alex Weiser of Weiser Family Farms. You can find him at a bunch of markets in the LA area, including Wednesday and Saturday, Santa Monica, Friday, Venice, Saturday at Virginia Park and Pasadena, Sundays in Hollywood, Mar Vista, Long Beach, and Beverly Hills. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Elena Shatkin, Laurel Garcia, Jillian Ferguson, Kenny Ng, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, and PJ Shahamat. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, Amy Tong, Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. Right now, in my garden, I'm cultivating cherry tomatoes in pots, and they're doing surprisingly well with the new watering regime. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of Good Food.